discussion was mentioned on the flotation. This is a standard procedure, what is required for the proper flotation of a certain size boathouse that is built. This is nothing new. This is nothing that hasn't been around for years. I find it unusual that this bid is so high. So anyway, I'd like to see a little bit more time on this. I'd like to talk to Steelhead Construction, Ducks Construction, see if they were in the process of submitting a bid, and see why this bid is so extremely high. So I hope that you extend this out another week, because I feel this bid is outrageous. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, any other public testimony?
Here, I move to accept the procurement report.
Is there a second?
Second.
Then let's move to consider that and adopt.
Fritz? So it is disappointing that the initial estimate of cost was so far off, and so it would be helpful to scope out so that the questions that have been on the council and from our testifier are scoped out early in the project. I know that there was an attempt to do that. To clarify, about $800,000 of this cost will be from the grant and about $800,000 from the general obligation bond that the voters passed in February of 2010. So my understanding is there's no general fund implications on this project. And I appreciate that it is important to protect our expensive, valuable resources, both of people and of the equipment in the Fire Bureau. Thank you. Aye.
Fish. I appreciate the briefings we received and the council discussion. And as the chief mentioned, the original estimate was a very low confidence estimate. And we do assign values to estimates to guide our, I would certainly have a different view if we were told it was a high confidence estimate. And we're back here with this bid, but that was not the case. With the grant, which I think shows a creativity in covering the additional cost, I understand we're within about $100,000 of the original estimate. Based on the conversation I've heard today, I'm comfortable moving forward, and based on what Commissioner Fritz just clarified on the record, that a general obligation bond and grant money is funding this and the general fund is not being placed at risk, I am comfortable moving forward today. Thank you, Chief and team, for your presentation, and Commissioner Novick for bringing this matter forward. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I appreciate this discussion. I think it's all, you know, I do want to see the contract language that really absolves the city of any responsibility should the grant go away due to actions on Oregon Ironworks missing April 24th. I'd also like to see something about the Bureau's fulfillment of the Greenway permit conditions. So if you can provide me an update on that, I would appreciate that as well. Aye.
Novick.
I'd just like to echo Commissioner Fish's comments and congratulate the Bureau on its work here. I mean, the Council saw a low-confidence estimate of $800,000. Then there's a bid of $2.6 million. And then through working with the contractor to reduce the cost from the original bid and getting this grant, we're back spending the same amount of money approximately that the council was originally advised of in a low confidence estimate. So I congratulate the Bureau on snatching victory from the jaws of defeat, and I vote aye.
Hales.
I wasn't around for the earlier phases of this discussion, and I also want to appreciate the work that's been done and this grant coming to the rescue. So good work for seeking and obtaining those grant funds. Something perhaps for us to think about, not just on Fire Bureau projects, but our specifications for these purchases, buildings, equipment, whatever. If they're written so narrowly that only one bidder will bid, we're not in a strong position. So whether we're buying, you know, pencils or fire stations or community centers, you know, the details of what we specify matter and how unique it is. So there's a standard question there that I think we ought to weigh and look at as we move into other purchasing decisions, whether they're funded by bond measures or by other general revenues. So it's just something I'd like to flag. But it seems to me as a sometime construction guy that we may have painted ourselves a little bit into a corner here by the specifications that we wrote fortunately, you've gotten us out of that corner with the timely and successful obtaining of this grant. But nevertheless, there maybe is a cautionary tale there, and we don't want to put ourselves in that position very often. Nevertheless, appreciate the good work that's been done, and I vote aye. Okay. Thank you. Item 76.
Replace the sewer user charges code for consistency of definitions, clarification of terms, and addition of enforcement measures.
Mr. Saltzman, do you have any direction for this item?
It's the second reading, yep. I don't know anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. It is second reading, yes. Okay. Any testimony? Then, Council, let's vote.
Fritz. Thanks to Amy Chu in Commissioner Saltzman's office and Patty Howard in mine. Aye.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I want to thank Amy Chu also and Patty Howard and all the staff of the Bureau of Environmental Services for their hard work on this code update. Aye.
Novick.
Aye.
Hales.
Aye.
Item 77, please.
Pay award ordered by the Employment Relations Board in Portland Firefighters Association v. City of Portland UP-013-10 on December 10, 2012, pending review by the Oregon Court of Appeals.
Mr. Van Dyke, can you enlighten us?
I will try. Jim Van Dyke, City Attorney. The matter before you is an ordinance to comply with an order that we received from the Employment Relations Board in December of 2012, and it arises in a ongoing dispute that the city has with a grievance that was filed by one of the unions regarding firefighter Thomas Hurley. Without going through all the background to this particular dispute, let me try to just summarize it briefly. The city, pursuant to some reforms to the FPD&R system in 2006, instituted a return to work program. Mr. Hurley was ordered to return to work. He did not. The city took some action against him at that time to take him off the medical layoff list. That decision was grieved by the union. An arbitrator in 2010 ruled in his favor and not only reinstated him back to the position that he was in when the city took its action against him, but also ordered the city to pay him, and not the fund, but the city, to pay him back disability benefits over a three-year period of time. Subsequently, this city council adopted a resolution in 2010 that directed the city attorney's office to defend this case, and that's what we've been doing, and it currently is before the Oregon Court of Appeals, and we're waiting for a decision. While that was happening, the union returned to the arbitrator and to the Employment Relations Board, saying that the city also needed to provide Mr. Hurley with retirement service credits. Retirement service credits under as applied by the fund affect the amount of retirement benefits you get, and they affect when you can retire. In December of 2012, ERB ruled that Mr. Hurley was entitled to additional retirement service credits, and it also ordered the city, not the fund, to pay those additional credits. That was very explicit in ERB's order. This unusual situation is one reason why we're on have a current appeal before the Court of Appeals. In the meantime, ERB ordered us to provide these retirement service credits immediately, which would become effective when Mr. Hurley retired. He submitted his retirement papers or his intent to retire at the end of December of 2012, and so now we are in the position of having to provide him with these additional retirement service credits. Our office has looked into asking the Employment Relations Board for a stay of this order while it's on appeal, and we have concluded that we do not have the legal basis to ask for a stay. Ordinarily, the payment of money in and of itself does not constitute a legal basis for obtaining a stay. And in fact, when you may recall that I believe it was last year. The city was faced the same position when we had to pay Mr. Hurley some back disability benefits. We asked IRB for a stay at that time, and they rejected the stay. We don't think it necessary to go through that same exercise this time regarding his retirement benefits when the situation is identical. That is, we're in the position of having to pay him money. So this ordinance would authorize the city to pay the difference between what the FPD&R fund would pay to Mr. Hurley and would comply with the order of the Employment Relations Board. You will notice that the exhibit that's attached to the ordinance refers to a stream of payments over the next 2 years. We believe in the next 2 years, and actually we believe that within the next year, we'll have a ruling from the Court of Appeals. If that ruling is favorable to the city, we believe that ruling will allow the city to discontinue those additional payments, and we would then be in the position of asking Mr. Hurley to pay those payments back to the city. So the ordinance also authorizes the city and the city attorney's office to try to recover those payments if the Court of Appeals rules in our favor. So, if the Court of Appeals does not rule in the city's favor, we will have to come back to the city, to City Council, and ask for additional authority to pay additional funds to Mr. Hurley, because obviously his retirement benefits are due over his anticipated lifespan, which is another 20 or so years into the future, and this ordinance only authorizes us to pay for the next couple of years. We believe this ordinance satisfies IRB's order to us from December, and we also believe it preserves the city's ability to contest the matter on appeal by giving us this limited grant of authority to pay the money. If the city were to refuse to comply with IRB's order, IRB has already told us that they would try to file an action in the circuit court. They would probably be represented by the Attorney General or by outside counsel to obtain a circuit court judgment ordering the city to comply. I don't believe and I don't recommend that that's the position or the road that we walk down, especially since we would have virtually no defense to that lawsuit. We would have to admit that we had not complied with IRB's order.
Mayor, yes. If I may, since there's a little bit of history to this case, and I just think it's since we had very succinct and I think thoughtful presentation by the city attorney, if I may just add a comment. When the arbitrator ruled against FPD&R and the city, and Dan, when was that? Was that a year and a half ago?
We had a
very spirited discussion at this council. Well, in fact, it was probably the hottest and most spirited discussion that I can remember. Dan, you might remember one that had more heat. But at the heart of it was a very, in my opinion, based on 20-something years of practicing in the field of employment relations, an important question about whether an arbitrator had the authority in fashioning a remedy in a case that put the city in the position of paying for a violation that the arbitrator determined FPD&R had made. Now, whether we agree or disagree with the merits of the decision, it was the view of a majority of the council then that what we were doing, excuse the pun, is we were in a sense blurring a firewall that existed between the city's general fund and FPD&R, and the arbitrator's decision essentially was setting a precedent that someone could in effect get two bites at the apple. They could file a challenge to FPD&R's rulings, but they could also file a grievance under the city's collective bargaining agreement and seek relief under that, and ultimately hold the city liable, the city's general fund, for something that, in my view, and Dan's view, and others' views, really ought to be within the purview of FPD&R. Now, this issue, I understand, is now in our legislative agenda, and the question of that firewall may be addressed legislatively. I personally believe that the decision was wrong, and I also believe that it runs the risk, significant risk, of reducing public confidence in our pension and disability system by the blurring of the lines. There's a big disagreement in the community with some of our friends on that question, but I think in terms of our stewardship, both of the pension disability fund and then of the general fund, I think it's a vitally important question. We had no illusions when we lost the arbitrator's award that there was a clean path to getting it overturned at the ERB or the court. In fact, we were advised that there is a very narrow legal basis to challenge an arbitrator's award. But for better or worse, Mr. Hurley's case has become kind of a poster child, if you will, for what some people think are some abuses in the system. And I think we were obligated to take this appeal forward as a council, and we voted to do so. And now I personally think we're obligated to follow the advice of counsel to do what's called mitigating our damages, to do some prudent things to make sure that if we lose at the next level, our costs don't keep mounting. But I think ultimately the significant question that's before us is not resolved by our action today or by the action of the Court of Appeals. It's really resolved either legislatively or at the table, because the general fund, in my view, should not be placed at risk of resolving disputes which are appropriately between a beneficiary and a fund. And I think if we allow those lines to be blurred, it's going to create a series of unintended consequences which will work to the detriment of both beneficiaries and the administrators of the fund. That's just my view, and that sparked once upon a time a very spirited debate in this chamber. But I am going to support this measure, not because I want to reward Mr. Hurley, but because I think in terms of our legal strategy, it's the proper thing to do to limit our exposure. And if we are successful on appeal, as the city attorney has noted, we have the right to seek reimbursement of the additional funds that are paid to him. But ultimately, I think this is bad for the entire system, because I think it paints a picture of a system that can be exploited in ways that, frankly, I don't think were ever intended.
So given the tremendous precedent at risk here, namely that the city's general fund is on the hook for claimants that are not satisfied with a decision of the independent Fire, Police, Disability, and Retirement Board, and given that we did pass a resolution, I forgot when it was, December of 2010?
10.
Which, as I recall, in essence said we're gonna fight like hell to against Mr. Hurley in this judgment. I mean, so given the tremendous precedent at risk in this ruling, given our resolve earlier to fight like hell, I mean, is there a reason why we shouldn't simply not pay anything until we get a Court of Appeals ruling or a legislative fix?
Well, I think we're in the unfortunate position of having been ordered to pay by the Employment Relations Board, and unless we could get a stay of that ruling or unless we thought we had some other legal options that would prevent us from paying at the present time, I frankly don't see any alternative but for us to go forward, even though the matter is on appeal. And it's very unfortunate that that's the legal position that we find ourselves in, but the courts are applying a very standard rule of law that applies in virtually all cases, that payment of money by itself will not justify a stay of the ruling of the administrative body or a court, for that matter.
Jim, what's the statutory interest rate on any of the amounts we're required to pay by order if we choose not to?
The statutory interest rate would be 9%.
So the additional challenge here, and by the way, just to Dan's points, I think it's an excellent one. By following your guidance and making this payment, we are in no way conceding that he's owed the money. We are simply complying with an order, and that cannot be used against us in the litigation, correct?
That is correct. I'm sorry if I didn't address that earlier, but this does not create any concession or admission on the city's part that our appeal should not succeed.
One of the things that concerns me is, as galling as it is to write a check today, it would be even more galling to write a bigger check down the road that factors in things like interest, and knowing that the city attorney's office has also had to expend limited resources on challenging an order where, at least at the ERB level, that's a very difficult road, as I understand it. So those are among the factors that persuade me, at least, that this is something we should do and just swallow hard.
Mr. Mayor, I'd also like to add that, and fellow commissioners, I'd also like to add that we're in front of ERB on a fairly regular basis, and I think that we'd be advised not to defy one of their orders when the city attorney is saying us that we have no real legal basis for that. I think that you want to maintain as cordial a relationship with the body with power over you as you can.
Okay, other questions for Jim? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any other public testimony on this item?
Yes, we had one person sign up. Alan Furschweiler.
Morning.
For the record, Alan Furschweiler, I'm the president of the Portland Firefighters Association.
For the record, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You were just recently elected, right?
Yes, I was. And so Jim Forquet is no longer here, so I'm here to take the reins from him. So thank you for letting me speak for a moment. The one thing I did want to reiterate is the reason this is in front of the city, one, this has been three union presidents that have worked on this case. It's been going on a long time. But the thing is that when we look at what happened in the past, why is the city really involved is because the city is the one that terminated Mr. Hurley's employment. And when you look at how the ERB board has decided where they wanted to go, it's because the city brought him back as an employee and then terminated him. And that's what makes it a grievance, is because it was a just cause grievance, which the city was not able to support the just cause for that termination. and so if we fast forward to where we're at today, I think this gets us closer to where we need to be for resolution for this. It's not ideal that this comes out of the city general fund. I can't reiterate enough that it's the union's position that this should be coming out of the FPDNR levy and that he should be made whole there. And as a remedy, having that board decide whether they could give him his years of service would also, if the board decided to do that and vote on it, they would have the ability to make him whole, and then we could be over with this matter. and when you look at the past 30 days, I think this has really accelerated in the past 30 days because of the final ERB board motion that was made on December 10th. And that said within the 30 days to make the grievant completely whole. And so on the 11th, I chose to file with the ERB board that the city had not complied with that. And we've been in constant communication with them. I believe we're all working in good faith to get this completed. And so after you guys vote on it next week, we'll be notifying of the board of the city's good faith and making this payment and that we are working towards resolution. And so that's pretty much what I had for you guys. I also just wanted to be here to see if you guys had any specific questions that I could answer for you also.
Well, first of all, welcome in your new capacity.
Thank you.
As you know, we had a very productive working relationship with your predecessor, and we hope that continues. And I think the lightning speed in which a successor contract was agreed to was evidence of what a good collaborative relationship means. And so look forward to supporting you in your transition.
Thank you.
And I appreciate very much what you said in your prepared comments, that it's the union's position that it was, in fact, the FPDNR fund that should have been tapped to bring make Mr. Hurley whole. And I would hope going forward that while it is certainly your job to fight like heck on behalf of your members, and we respect the role that you play, that the parties in fashioning proposed remedies in arbitration work to avoid a situation like this happening in the future, because it's my view, as someone who believes that your members deserve a decent pension benefit, that it's these kinds of anomalous cases that really undermine public confidence in the system, and that I think is bad for you and bad for us and the people that we serve. And I hope that in the future we can work together to avoid that.
Absolutely. And I think that the one anomaly was at the start of the return to work program after the 2006 reforms. And Mr. Hurley was a portion of that. And if we could have had that completely ironed out and been on the same page at that point, I think we could have avoided this also at that point.
Thank you.
Didn't, in fact, Mr. Hurley refuse to come back to return to work?
under the return to work?
Yes, he did. And that's why the city brought him back and then terminated him. But the return to work program, again, that's at the Oregon Court of Appeals, too. That still is not completely resolved. In terms of the union's position was that you guys had to bargain that, the city's position that we did not have to bargain that, and right now it's at the Oregon Court of Appeals.
So, Mr. Firstweiler, I appreciate you being here. You mentioned, I think your last words were, as we work towards full resolution of this, so what does full resolution look like to you, that the FPD&R fund would pay Mr. Hurley? Is that what
I think the full resolution, one, you can look at the future of the legal litigation. Ideally for the union, not going to the Oregon Court of Appeals would be the ideal scenario. And I understand from the city's point of view that they have to do their due diligence and take that forward. And we understand that and respect that decision. I think the end goal that would be ideal is that the pension board recognizes the time of service while he was terminated, as ERB has ordered the city to do. And then that way the city would have completely separated from it. The pension would pay his retirement, his full retirement, and then the city would not have to come back as a resolution in case the Court of Appeals finds in the union's favor. That would be the ideal scenario for us. And one more quick comment, if I may. I think that I understand that this has become a poster of a case, but I can tell you, especially since I've been employed in 2001, the FPD&R system has came a long way. And I think that you can look at one or two cases out of 700 firemen that are not ideal scenarios. But that percentage is going lower and lower and lower every day. Your employees that work for the Fire Bureau and that I represent do a great job, and I think this is not ideal for everybody, because I believe that they really do a good job and they're not trying to scam any type of system. So I would just like to close on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other testimony? If not, roll call, please.
I think it goes to a second.
Oh, I'm sorry, does it? Thank you. Second reading next week, then.
Mayor, we're prepared to take up item 67.
And I think you mean among the consent items that were pulled off. Can we do 67 first, and then you want to get 73 in before you go?
Right, I think it's the auditor staff here, too.
Pardon me?
I have to leave at 11:30, and I have a discussion on 73. But
67 will take 2 minutes.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Item 67, amend the expenditure authorization for subrecipient contracts with Transition Projects, Inc. for an additional $269,000 for services to operate women's winter shelter and provide for payment.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Hales, excuse me.
I had good suggested it.
It's been done.
I've been referred to as Commissioner Fritz for so long, I think I was due one. My own malapropism. Mr. Walsh, will you come forward? Sally Erickson, Mr. Ryan, would you come forward? Mayor and colleagues, the matter before you is a very straightforward request for authorization to distribute funds previously budgeted to Transition Projects, Inc., which is running our Women's Winter Shelter program. That program, by the way, is oversubscribed this winter for obvious reasons. But this is a straightforward matter. The funding has already been budgeted. The Bureau selected Transition Projects to run the program. This simply seeks authority to distribute the funds. And my understanding is that Mr. Walsh has a concern unrelated to the distribution of the funds, but more aligned with a larger policy question. And I think it might be more fruitful to take his testimony first.
Please.
Commissioner Fish is absolutely right. I'm not objecting to the $269,000 that you're going to add. My concern is that with one hand, you're doing something that I support, and that's helping people that are in desperate shape. I applaud that. On the other hand, you are trying to close down Right to Dream 2, which costs this city nothing. They pay their own bills. The police are rarely called there because they don't allow drugs or booze. But you're trying to close it down by fining it every month. The logic here, and I know I'm Irish, but the logic here is damaged. You're saving 70 people over here. You have 70 people in R2-D2, which is a strange figure. That's why I noticed this. If you close down that camp, you will move 70 new people on the street. Where is the logic in that, gentlemen? Lady. It's my question. Can someone explain it to me?
Okay, thank you. Thanks. You
want to? So, Mayor, technically, the matter before us is just to authorize the distribution. Mr. Walsh is raising a point he's made before about how, on a regulatory side, we're dealing with R2-D2. We obviously appreciate his testimony, but it's not actually germane to the matter before us. And I have a staff person here who is prepared. This is Ryan Diebert from the Ending Homelessness team. He can talk about the 269,000, but he's not here prepared to talk about R2-D2.
I understand. So maybe just a brief note about where these funds are going to go, they're going to do.
Sure. So
can you state your name for the record?
Yeah. My name is Ryan Diebert. I work with the Portland Housing Bureau Ending Homelessness Programs. These funds were, as Commissioner Fish summarized, allocated as part of our 12-13 budget specifically to provide winter shelter. In this instance, we're taking those funds that were allocated to the budget, applying them specifically to the contract for transition projects to operate a 70-bed shelter through the winter months from mid-November through mid-April for women. Currently, in the 2 months of operations to date, they've already served 310 women, providing 47 permanent housing placements for women coming out of that facility.
Great. Thank you. Further council discussion? Then let's take a roll call on this item.
Fritz.
Thank you for your work and thank you for your advocacy. Aye.
Fish.
Pleased to bring this forward, Mayor, and I want to also please to acknowledge our wonderful Ending Homelessness team at the Portland Housing Bureau, Ryan Diebert, Sally Erickson, and Jennifer Chang. And they are also the team that's been administering the severe weather emergency system this winter, which has been triggered now, I think, on 5 or 6 different nights. So when you get those alerts that say that we're opening up additional capacity, Imago Day, and other locations staffed by the Red Cross, those are triggered and then supervised by the team that act in a rotating basis as the incident commanders to make sure that anybody who is outside during a weather emergency has the opportunity to go inside for their own safety. So I'm very proud of their work and pleased to vote aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Novick.
Aye.
Hales.
It's a cold winter out there, and I saw that alert as well about all the additional shelter that we were able to open up. So these kinds of, we're not doing enough, whether it's through partners or on our own efforts, but everything we can do, aye. Thank you both. Okay, now, I know you're on a clock here, Commissioner Fritz. So let's, 63, I simply want to return that to my office, I believe.
63?
Yeah.
Grant a franchise to Lucid Energy, Inc. for a renewal energy project in conjunction with the Water Bureau for a period of 20 years.
So I believe I'm going to request to return this to my office for 1 week. No objection? And then let's take up 73.
Update council procedures regarding publication of the council agenda.
Comes the auditor's office team. Good morning. Well, this is a switch. Carla gets to come testify.
Not my favorite position.
finally get to ask you some questions. Under oath. Okay.
This is a rare event. This is cool. Good Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning. So this is a request to update
state your name,
Sarah
your name.
Landis, City Auditor's Office. Thank you for the reminder. This is a request to update the city code regarding our publication of the city council agenda. We received notification from the Daily Journal of Commerce that they would be switching from daily publication to Monday, Wednesday, Friday publication, so that we would not be able to get the agenda in the Tuesday edition anymore. So after reviewing the options with the city attorney, we decided to do a code change to change the requirements for publication, that this would not change the requirements for notification prior to a meeting. Charter requires 24 hours notice prior to the meeting, and code requires publication in the official paper of record. So it's that official paper of record distribution that we're changing, seeking to change in this a code change. We did look into the feasibility of Monday publication, but the DJC's deadline for print is Thursday at 5 o'clock, which is the same time as our filing deadline is for council items. So that was not an option for us either. And Lindley, who's here, was the attorney that reviewed the request for this change and how to make this happen. And I think Tony and Carla are here to provide any other technical details that you might need.
So what are you doing instead? I'm sorry.
The change would be to just distribute the agenda via email and post it on the website. And according
no,
to
no publication in the convention.
We would still publish in the Wednesday paper, so it would still be available outside council chambers for those who want to follow along the agenda in that manner.
Okay, I get it.
So, Mayor, I asked for this this to be pulled so that we could have a discussion. I'm concerned about not relying only on internet access to the agenda before Wednesday morning, because we know that a certain percentage of our citizens don't have internet access. So although they probably don't have much greater access to the Daily Journal of Commerce, it does highlight a discussion that the three members of the council who were serving last year will well remember, and that is that it would be in everybody's best interest to move the filing deadline to Tuesday at 5 o'clock instead of Thursday at 5 o'clock. That would then enable you to get into the Monday Daily Journal of Commerce as the paper of record. It would also have the much, I think, more significant benefit of giving council offices additional time to look through council agenda items, particularly on short weeks like this one where we had just coming back after the weekend, even though you were able to put the agenda out early. So I would propose a different solution. If we are going to go with only internet access, I think that more needs to be done, and I'm not prepared to vote on this code item today because I think that there is some significant public involvement that should be required in having a discussion with our communities about how they would best be able to get up to find out what the agenda is. But in the meantime, it seems to me that rather than changing the code, it would be better to change the filing deadline because there's multiple benefits to that.
With the Tuesday deadline, you're giving us Wednesday to file to do the agenda. I'm in council all day Wednesdays and most of the Thursday afternoons. We have no more staff to do this agenda than Sue or I.
So then the discussion that we had had on that was why it was moving it to Tuesday rather than Wednesday, is that, yes, acknowledging that Wednesday is not available for staff to work on the agenda. Currently the deadline is Thursday at 5, and you get it out with remarkable speed as soon as you can on Friday.
It's an all-day process on Friday. Right.
Right. So then the expectation would be, especially for the printing in the Daily Journal of Commerce, you don't have to have all the links done by then. On the rare days that we have council on Thursday afternoons, it seems reasonable that you could at least get the list of the titles to the Daily Journal of Commerce by Thursday evening, and then on those days, we wouldn't get the council agenda coming out until Friday. But we could still have the letter of the code met under that circumstance, and most days, most weeks, when we don't have Thursday councils, you could get the agenda done on Thursdays instead of on Fridays, as you usually do.
Sounds like a workload problem.
It is.
Tony Anderson, City Auditor's Office. I do have a concern with Thursdays. If there is a Thursday afternoon meeting, we wouldn't be able to finalize the agenda until after the meeting if something was to carry over to make it into the agenda. So there's there's some timing issues also.
When is the DJC schedule changing? When is their publication schedule changing?
1st of February, so it would be effective with our February 6th agenda.
So this is time sensitive, at least to the extent you want to have a backup as they change. I've also, Commissioner Fritz, wondered the question that you alluded to, which is, how do people get information about our agenda? I mean, I know we have Daily Journal of Commerce in the rack here, but I'd be very curious to know how average citizens learn about our agenda. And my guess is that very few of them actually subscribe to DJC, and that would include neighbor activists, neighbor associations, and others. So they probably do what I do, which is go on the city's website and pull it down. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to know more about that, how people actually get the information and what's the preferred, before I'm prepared to vote on a change of filing, because while I appreciate Commissioner Fritz's concept, I'd like to start by knowing how people get information and work from that body of information before we change our filing deadlines and inadvertently create a workload problem. But the question I guess I have for today is, this is an emergency matter before us. Do you need us to act today so at least we can adapt, so we have enough time to be teed up when they change their publication schedule? And if so, is Commissioner Fritz's concept something we can revisit later?
I think we would prefer to be in compliance with code when the change takes place on February 1st, obviously, and we've been open to discussion about changing the filing deadline, certainly in the past, and will continue to be so. But we have, as Carla and Tony mentioned, we do have considerable workload issues. A 5 o'clock Tuesday deadline doesn't help us much because Carla and Sue usually are busy Wednesday and most of Thursday. So it would have to be an early Tuesday filing deadline for us to change in any case to make the Thursday afternoon DJC print deadline.
Yeah, I'm persuaded by what Commissioner Fish said, but not immune to what you're talking about, Commissioner Fritz, and that is, this is internal procedure. We're adopting it today. I mean, hopefully we wouldn't do it every month, but we can change our internal procedures anytime we want. A little different, a little higher hurdle for changing filing day, but that's also internal procedure. So,
Do you have a Bureau Advisory Committee that gives input onto things like this?
We do have a Budget Advisory Committee, yes.
And has this issue been taken to them?
It has not been brought up with them.
Well,
we don't currently have a contract with the DJC, so we're already out of compliance.
Well, we don't have a contract with the DJC to be the official paper of record. If I understand the history of that correctly, that was sort of let go, I guess, back in 2005. But in the absence of that contract, we've been advised by council that the official paper of record is still the Daily Journal of Commerce.
In code.
Is that correct, Lindley?
The problem is that the daily, the official paper of the city is not because of this need to publish. It's because of the need to publish RFPs. And so purchasing has continued to use the DJC. There's numerous charter and code provisions that require publication of certain things in the official paper. And we've been using it consistently.
But nothing prevents us, for example, from publishing our agenda in the Mercury.
Nothing.
Or Willamette.
No. And one thing I just want to make clear in terms of the advice to the auditor's office is there's a difference between what's required in state law and the policy of what you want to do in terms of making sure there's transparency in the decision making. So from a state law perspective, simply publishing it on the city's website and providing email notice to interested persons satisfies the state law requirement for notice.
Well, it seems to me we've got a small matter and a bigger matter here. We've got the small matter of the fact that the DJC is no longer, I assume they're going to change their name, but they're not daily anymore, very shortly. And the larger matter is that there are big changes underway in the newspaper industry in general, and that they may not be the only publication that changes its schedule. And yet, we have not only an obligation to get the word out about council agendas, but also RFPs and bid notices, back to our earlier discussion. So we have a communication challenge of how we're going to adapt to those tectonic shifts in how people are getting their information and the fractioning of how people get their information. That's a big subject, which I think we ought to take up, but not now, not today with this. My suggestion is we ought to adopt this change not blow off the questions that you've raised, but take it into a larger discussion about public information in general, given these pretty big changes.
I think the bigger question is how do people get information about what the council is doing?
Right.
And that, you know, the Planning Commission publishes a small notice in the Oregonian with an abbreviated version of the agenda. And so I am not prepared to vote for this today. So I would propose that we bring it back next week and have some discussions in the interim about either a large or a small fix.
And Mayor, if I could, there was a piece in a local newspaper today indicating that Osberg had given the city low marks for general transparency around being able to access certain kinds of information. That might be a function of the old website, which we're converting. That might be also a function of consistency across bureaus.
Yeah.
It seems to me that what Commissioner Fritz has raised is a bigger question than just the following of our agenda, and it might warrant a specific focus, perhaps led by a commissioner, to make recommendations for on the question of transparency, notice, and that. And I would also suggest that the public process around that go beyond the Bureau Advisory Committee for the auditor, but take into account the views of our key stakeholders, including the 95 neighborhood associations.
Thank you, Commissioner Fish. That's an excellent suggestion. Indeed, the Public Involvement Advisory Committee, which also includes half city staff from various bureaus, might be an excellent source of providing some recommendations for that.
Well, I guess I'm given the sort of issues here, I'm not sure we're going to get any resolution in a week.
No.
So I'm going to move that we remove the emergency clause and make that motion.
We remove it and therefore?
Yeah, so that we would have a
it's an emergency
second reading,
clause
a vote next week. Is that correct?
Well, then
correct.
It would
go past a second reading and then it'd be effective in 30 days.
Right.
And then
I think we can take some risk about the fact it's not effective to go ahead and keep publishing in the Daily Journal.
Right. And then we would be in compliance with code.
Yeah, I just don't know how any solution is going to be reached in 1 week. So, again,
if you leave the emergency on and we are able to come to some agreement, then it would be reached before the end of the month.
Well,
I guess
it's agreement with you, Commissioner Fritz. I'm not sure I'm on your side on some of these issues after listening here. So it gives you sort of the unilateral ability to make this from happening. That's why I'm saying
well, putting the emergency on
clause,
in the first place does that.
Let's remove the emergency clause, vote on it next week.
But Dan, can I
think what you're outlining, Commissioner Fritz, is a longer-term deal. It's just not going to come to resolution in a week.
So I think I'm suffering from jet lag because now I'm confused about something. I believe there are four votes to pass this. And if so, why not keep the emergency clause so we keep this on pace to accomplish what these three...
You need all five
people.
You
need people. Everybody.
Unanimous.
Oh,
excuse me. Everyone's
yeah.
present.
Unanimous.
Yeah.
You need at least
oh, I see.
Four.
And Commissioner Fritz... Based on the comments of the mayor that he would like to see this go on a two-track, are you satisfied enough either not to vote on this matter or to vote aye?
I would like another week to look at it. I can't tell you what outcome we can get out. We have been discussing this for at least 2 years.
Well, that may be the case, but I think this is not something like many things here that will benefit from being rushed. It doesn't mean I don't want to address it. I do, and I think the suggestion that he made of having a commissioner, maybe you would be interested, lead that effort about how do we deal with the public, how do we interface with the public, given all these changes, is a big and important question, or a set of questions. We need to take that up. But we're not going to get that done in a week, and frankly, I think we're not going to learn much in another week.
Well, we might have something in the ordinance that we would pass next week directing PIAC and others to do certain things, which would then...
Well, let's take longer to figure that out, Amanda. This is procedure. We can change it again in a month if we have to. But we may not be able to persuade you.
I cannot in good conscience vote for this and it's an emergency today. If we have a week to look at some amendments to this that would then set out a process for making a decision for better publication of the agenda and more opportunity for citizens to engage in a meaningful way on agenda items, then I could possibly vote for something as an emergency next week.
Mayor, I second the motion to take the emergency clause off.
Okay. Let's take a vote on that.
Fritz.
No.
Fish.
We're removing the emergency clause through this vote. Aye.
Salzman.
Aye.
Novick.
Aye.
Hales.
Aye. The emergency clause is removed, and it will be back next week.
Actually, Mr. Mayor, could I ask Carla a question?
Sure.
What happens if we don't pass this and the Daily Journal of Commerce ceases publication on Tuesdays, as they say they're going to do? What position would we be in next month?
Well, our code would still be stating we have to officially publish it, so we'd be out of compliance with code not publishing it. That's why that was our main focus, was to get that phrase out of there, officially publishing it, because we feel like we were okay distributing it on emails and online, having it online, but still in the Wednesday DJC. We've looked into the Argonian, and their prices is very high.
How high? Just out of curiosity.
It's $2,351.41 per insertion.
What are we paying the Daily Journal of Commerce?
Nothing.
Oh. That's good to know.
That's a fairly big delta there.
Yeah.
That's a good price. 2,400 times more. Okay.
I need you guys to do some negotiating for me on a few contracts.
Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.